Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us. Those were protests this week in Wisconsin and Michigan as Republicans aggressively tried to limit the powers of incoming Democratic governors.
Listen, I'm concerned. I think that Governor-elect Evers is going to bring a liberal agenda to Wisconsin.
Republicans in Wisconsin and Michigan will still have the majority in both state legislatures, but they're using these lame duck periods in both of those states to make legislative changes that could severely limit the power of the governorship. We saw similar moves in North Carolina 2 years ago.
What's extraordinary about this lame duck session is the Republican strategy is so obvious, and they're not making any effort to hide their partisanship here.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, a look at what these partisan moves mean for our democracy. To learn more about what's going on in these lame duck sessions, I spoke with Esther Fuchs, a professor of political science at Columbia University, and Tara Golshan, a political reporter for Vox.
They are anticipating a Democratic leadership team coming in January in Wisconsin and Michigan, and just on Wednesday morning, the Senate in Wisconsin passed a sweeping proposal that would curb a lot of the powers of not only the incoming governor, but also the attorney general. And the same goes in Michigan, where, again, a completely Democratic team of governors, attorney general, and secretary of state will be coming in, and they have proposals that would curb the powers of all three of them.
Now, what are some of the proposals, Tara, that the Republicans voted on in Michigan?
So they're still up for debate. They haven't voted on all of them in Michigan, but some of the proposals include things that would let the Republican-led state legislature intervene in cases around state laws that the attorney general might not want to defend. For example, in Michigan, there is a legal battle around a law that allows faith-based adoption services to not work with same-sex couples that the incoming attorney general has said she might not want to defend. So those are the kinds of things that the Republican-led legislature could then intervene in. There are also changes to the new gerrymandering constitutional amendment that passed in Michigan and a ballot initiative that they would make the rules around identification a little bit stronger. There's just a slew of changes there.
And what about in Wisconsin, Tara?
In Wisconsin, Republicans have been very proactive negotiating all night to now pass bills that would really undermine the role of the attorney general, require legislative oversight if the attorney general wants to withdraw from any legal cases. For example, the federal case about the Affordable Care Act, which the incoming attorney general has said he would like to remove Wisconsin from. It would also require legislative oversight for different appointments to state agencies and generally the governor's power over state agencies, like the job development agency that the incoming governor said that he would like to get rid of, that would be essentially blocked by a Republican legislature, and just changes around welfare and health care, all of these policies that Tony Evers, a Democrat, campaigned and won on, could really be blocked by a Republican-led legislature.
Esther, can you help us make sense of what the Republican strategy is in both of these states? What are they trying to do during their lame duck sessions?
Well, what's extraordinary about this lame duck session is the Republican strategy is so obvious, and they're not making any effort to hide their partisanship here. It's really a blatant power grab. It's designed to strip executive authority and move it over to the legislature, and it's clearly partisan. And I would say, doing this after an election really subverts the will of the voters. It's anti-democratic small d.
Tara, what are some of the broader implications that you're seeing coming out of what we're seeing in both Michigan and Wisconsin?
I mean, you're really seeing an election that handily gave Democrats the chance to lead in these states, especially in the case of Michigan, with very clear political platforms and policy ideas, and Republican-led legislatures saying, no, we don't want that to happen. We don't want to reverse this legacy that we have established over the greater part of a decade in our states. And we're going to do everything we can to block that from happening. And I will say also in Wisconsin, they're passing a proposal that would cut down early voting and limit it to 2 weeks. Right now, it's up to the discretion of different regions of the state to establish how many days of early voting. So this would create some, they say, uniformity. But it would also limit early voting in some cases. And that is another attempt to really kind of rein in the voices that are being heard in elections.
And Esther, what does this tell us, I mean, really about our democracy here? You know, if those who have been elected have their powers reduced by the incumbent opposing party, what does that tell us about the institution of democracy here in the United States?
We are in big trouble. I say that not lightly. The whole basis and legitimacy of democratic governments really depend on elections because we're a representative democracy. And to the extent that the public thinks that elections were not fair and that the outcomes of elections can be subverted by the outgoing political party, you know, they lose faith in the democratic process. I mean, we've seen an assault on all of our institutions of democracy going on for, it is over a decade now. I mean, what we have in Wisconsin is really part of the legacy of their redistricting, their gerrymandering, and their efforts essentially to make it difficult for Democrats to win legislative seats. It's kind of amazing that in Wisconsin, Democrats won 54% of the vote, but were only able to pick up one legislative seat. And this is endemic all across the United States in places where Republicans have had the opportunity to redistrict. And of course, that happens at the state level. So we're seeing another example of an effort essentially to subvert the will of the people. And this can't go on. I mean, this has to have both the courts resolve these issues in favor of the people. And the legislature in this instance is really not representing the will of the people, which is kind of ironic when you think about it, since they're district-based. They are really going after our fundamental institutions of democratic governance.
Esther, I also want to bring in an additional layer here. We are also going to be looking specifically at the state of Wisconsin and its treatment of Black Americans, its Black constituents, which has been abysmal, quite frankly. And I look at these states and I look at Wisconsin, North Carolina, we mentioned Michigan. These are states that also have significant Black populations that have been gerrymandered as well. What does this tell us about how race has played into the political landscape here?
Well, one of the interesting examples, of course, is always when you reduce the power of cities, you're generally reducing the power of minorities, African Americans, and Latino voters, because populations are concentrated in cities. And so these state legislatures and the previous Republican governors have been essentially taking away power from their cities and also changing laws as it relates to union representation. You know, we know about the contentious battles that existed both in Michigan and Wisconsin over union representation. And of course, a lot of African Americans, particularly road into the middle class, has been through civil service and through municipal work. And when you reduce the power of the unions, you reduce wages and benefits of both whites and African Americans, but especially African Americans in the Midwest states. And when you combine that with the gerrymandered districting that compresses African American and Latino populations into one, two, maybe three districts and reduces their impact to influence elections for legislative districts and the presidency, you're really finding a situation in which the Republican Party is once again increasing the racial divide in this country and hurting Black and African American and Latino populations.
Esther Fuchs is a professor of political science at Columbia University, and Tara Gulshan is a political reporter for Vox. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Black people are actually dying because of living in Wisconsin, and that's unconscionable to me.
By many measures, Wisconsin is one of the worst places for Black Americans to live. In the cities of Milwaukee and Racine, Black Americans make half of the median income of whites and are 11 times more likely to be incarcerated, according to a report from 24/7 Wall Street.
That investment in African Americans is not there.
Dr. Alex G. is the founder and president of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development, and he's lived in Madison for decades. And he said it wasn't always this way.
My family moved to Madison in 1970 because my mother was going through a divorce, was a high school dropout her freshman year. But when we showed up in Madison, she was invested in. They asked, What do you want to do? What do you want to become? Long and short of it is, my mom took the GED, took the entrance exam, got her undergraduate degree, paid cash for me and my sister to go to the university, and then she won a full fellowship to grad school. When people who look like my mom come here today, 50 years later, and they're a single mom from Chicago. Chicago is code for gangs. And we have blamed our problems on people from Chicago and Milwaukee and have not noticed that Madison-born African-Americans have not been thriving here for decades.
Despite his mother's success, Dr. G told me the stress of being Black in Wisconsin has continued to take its toll.
My family now has 12 degrees from Wisconsin. But we all suffer some stress-related illness from the isolation of living in this community. So even though we're trying to pursue the American dream and live out the Wisconsin idea, through the heights of Wisconsin's Black mortality rate, my wife lost two babies during that same time. And so we tend to think that those are uneducated, low-income Black moms who don't have fathers, who don't have prenatal care. But yet I can name a half dozen to a dozen professional Black women who also lost babies during that same period of time, and they're counted in those numbers. And so the impact of all of this is really horrendous, and we need a serious wake-up call.
In Wisconsin, there's a familiar phrase called the Wisconsin idea. Its origins go back to the early 1900s with University of Wisconsin President Charles Van Hise. He and the governor at the time, Robert La Follette, worked hand in hand focusing the government and the university's resources to usher in an era of prosperity for all families. Wisconsinites know it as their guide for public life, but that progress did not make its way to many of the state's Black residents.
For some folks, people are really struggling.
That's Angela Lang, the executive director of Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC.
Wisconsin is home to the most incarcerated zip code. Wisconsin is the worst place to raise a Black child. Milwaukee and Racine are on lists of greatest racial disparities. It's a struggle out here.
I spoke more with both Lang and Dr. Alex G.
I think it's a very tricky time for being Black in America. To be quite honest, I think what makes it increasingly more difficult in Wisconsin is that our state motto is forward. And we have a reputation of being this progressive liberal bastion, sort of particularly in Madison, the home of the flagship University of Wisconsin-Madison. There's a sense of progression that makes us above the types of challenges that we're experiencing in our state. So what it means in a place like Madison is that we look over our shoulders to the east and think, well, that's Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine, but we have things together. We don't see color. We have the university. We have state workers. And so Black people are doing well here, right? And I've lived here since 1970. I moved here as a six-year-old. We are anything but liberal.
Right. I mean, and that's why I was going to ask you about your work with incarceration.
Sure.
Because that indicator right there would show the opposite.
Definitely. Well, I remember when I started Nehemiah in the late 80s, I left my job at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I graduated and I worked there as an admissions officer and as an assistant to our chancellor. In the late 80s, we found that the Black population in Madison and Dane County basically doubled from 1980 to 1990. Those of us who are African-American influencers, I'm also the most tenured clergy person in our community. So I've been involved in leading a church for about the last 35 years. We said, hey, our population is growing. What we're noticing is that young people are going to mental health hospitals and juvenile correction facilities at a much faster rate than their white counterparts who are getting community service, first offender programs. We need more social workers, counselors. We need more judges. We need people in the system because Black children are not getting the same shake. No, we're Madison, we're progressive. Oh, Alex, we don't see color. We love everyone. You fast forward to where we are today, where we're leading the nation in the incarceration of Black people.
Angela, I want to turn the conversation a little bit towards political engagement of Blacks in Wisconsin specifically. We saw in 2016, African-American turnout drop by almost 20%. Obama did win the state. Hillary infamously lost the state. What can you tell us about that drop?
Yeah, I think one of my biggest takeaways from the drop is the level of engagement. I think there is a little bit of people just assumed Black folks voted for Obama. Black folks are automatically Democrats. We don't need to talk to them until a couple days before an election. When you had all of these things happening in the media, combined with not being authentically engaged and being engaged in a very transactional way, not just in 2016, but as a whole, I've seen campaigns, I've seen elected officials and candidates only knock doors in October saying, hey, vote for me, I'm going to change your life, never to be seen or heard from again. And so I think with a lot of communities, specifically communities of color and Black folks, is that people aren't here for that. Like, gone are the days where you can just show up the weekend before the election and just expect people to vote for you. You want our vote, come get our vote.
How much do you think segregation and racial animus is really at the root of these issues that we're talking about? You know, Dr. G, there are health discrepancies. Angela, we've talked about the political challenges, the incarceration issues. How much of this is bad policy and how much of it is really segregation at the root of this?
I think they feed each other. You know, it's interesting. The powers that be don't really listen to infected parties, to those who are most touched by these issues. And so one of the things I keep saying is that in 30 years of being a community activist, someone very involved in the community, I'm typically invited to the tables with my other Black colleagues once a policy, a plan, or report, once they've been prepared, and we've been asked to rubber stamp it. And if we say that this does not speak to our issues, we're treated and marginalized as angry people who are simple-minded, and we can never be satisfied. And so that's how things really are played out. Folks in Wisconsin, Black folks are thinking folks. We've got feelings. We've got experiences. We choose to live here. We're not banished here. We choose to live here. But yet, it's so difficult to bring our voices and our perspectives to the table. We've been talking about the stress of isolation, the microaggressions for years. But again, policy leaders aren't necessarily listening to that because they say, well, the unemployment is low. This is a great utopia. It'll be fine. Just work harder. We're now finding that disparities that used to only rear its head in Black and white reading rates and math rates are now becoming social determinants of premature death in Blacks by the same illnesses that our white counterparts have. We're now seeing the phenomenon in Wisconsin of something called racial battle fatigue, where now African-American people, after suffering other kinds of discrepancies, are now being shown to die more quickly and more often of the same illnesses that their white counterparts have. We're leading in most of them, and there's indications that show that it's really due to the microaggressions and the just the sense of isolation and sort of this pending frustration that happens in being in a progressively minded place like Wisconsin that's not responding to its Black population.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Dr. G that policy kind of fuels into and feeds into segregation. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're talking about segregation, specifically in Milwaukee, there's literal bridges that divide the North to the South Side, the North being predominantly Black, the South Side being predominantly Latinx. And there's a bridge. You see the dividing line. You see the neighborhoods physically change. And we can see how many folks are being policed at a higher rate. You know, we spend more, you know, as a state and, you know, also on the municipal level, we spend more on locking up our Black and brown folks than actually educating them. And, you know, how can we have thriving communities where we're not investing in our futures from a very political way and putting our money where our mouth is and being able to invest into thriving communities? And I think that shows that by and large, communities of color are not afforded the opportunity and the freedom to actually thrive because we're not being invested in, but we're being invested into locking up our futures instead of funding our futures.
Angela Lang is the Executive Director of Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC. Angela, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Alex G is founder and president of the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development. Dr. G, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
The funeral for President George H.W. Bush was today, after passing away November 30th at the age of 94.
With faith in Jesus Christ, we receive the body of our brother George for burial. Let us pray with confidence to God, the giver of life, that he will raise him to perfection in the company of saints.
Almighty God, look with pity upon the sorrow of your servants for whom we pray.
His son, President George W. Bush, delivered the eulogy.
When the history books are written, they will say that George H.W. Bush was a great president of the United States. A diplomat of unmatched skill, a commander-in-chief of formidable accomplishment, and a gentleman who executed the duties of his office with dignity and honor. So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
For many Americans, presidential funerals hold special significance.
Funerals for presidents are not only our way of saying goodbye, but they're a way of healing the nation.
Professor Barbara Perry is the Presidential Studies Director at the University of Virginia's Miller Center.
And in the case of Lincoln, it was to try to heal us after the Civil War. In the case of assassinated president like Kennedy, not during a Civil War as such, but leading up to the violence that would come from the Civil Rights Movement, it turns out these are our times when we do come together. And so I think they're not only very important mourning rituals for the family of the fallen president, whether that be at a natural age of 94 for President Bush, 41, or sadly for Kennedy at age 46 by assassination. It does at least momentarily bring the country together, and therefore it's an important ritual for our nation.
Central to our presidential funerals are the eulogies and the people who give them. The last time the country said goodbye to a president was in 2006 when Gerald Ford died, and George H.W. Bush himself spoke at that funeral. He used the opportunity to tell the world how he thought Gerald Ford brought the community together in the aftermath of Watergate.
As Americans, we generally eschew notions of the indispensable man, and yet during those traumatic times, few, if any, of our public leaders could have stepped into the breach and rekindled our national faith, as did President Gerald R. Ford.
Today, as the nation reflects on George H.W. Bush, we look back at presidential funerals from the nation's earliest days and how these moments have been used to call for unity for the nation in trying times. Louis Pacone is a presidential historian and author of The President is Dead, The Extraordinary Stories of the Presidential Deaths, Final Days, Burials, and Beyond.
The very earliest presidential funerals were much more modest affairs, nothing like we see today with the state funerals and that we're going to see with President Bush coming up over the next few days. They were mostly spontaneous or not pre-planned. So after the death, the funerals were kind of cobbled together without really much planning prior to the death. And actually, George Washington had asked for no funeral in his will, even though he did have a small funeral.
Aren't there eulogies or themes in presidential eulogies or words that stand out for you when you look back at presidential eulogies historically?
Yeah, I mean, to bring it maybe to more current time, one of the ones that stands out to me most is actually when Richard Nixon passed away and President Clinton had spoken on his behalf. So this was 1994. Nixon was a maligned former president. And over the next 20 years, he tried to redeem his reputation and his standing. So I think President Clinton, when he spoke, he said, "May the day of judging President Nixon
on anything less than his entire life and career come to a close. May we heed his call to maintain the will and the wisdom to build on America's greatest gift, its freedom, to lead a world full of difficulty to the just and lasting peace he dreamed of."
I thought that that was really powerful.
Do you think that at presidential funerals, as they've grown in size, have they taken on more significance over the years, at least in the eyes of the American people?
Yeah, they have. They've really become national events, multi-day events. I believe that that probably goes back to President McKinley. That's when it really started with these multi-day events. When he was assassinated in Buffalo, and his funeral train brought him from Buffalo to D.C. and then to Canton, Ohio. And it was this just multi-day extended cathartic period of mourning. It also happened with President Lincoln, actually even more substantially. But then there was a period where you didn't really see that as much.
You mentioned McKinley and Lincoln, and I was thinking also about President Kennedy. His funeral and the images from that funeral seem to really stand out to me when I think about presidential funerals and just iconic moments in American history. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And his was the first televised funeral. The nation was glued to their TV throughout those days, from the assassination of Kennedy all the way through the funeral. So it's probable that more people watch President Kennedy's funerals as a percentage of the country than any other presidential funeral. But the images of John John saluting his father and of all of the dignitaries walking to the church, and anyone that lived through that period and saw those images firsthand, it's something that they never forget.
And in particular, I'm thinking about the fact that these are rare moments where living presidents come together in one place with a common cause. And do you think that that is something that, particularly in this moment where the country feels quite divided, do you think that that matters to Americans?
Yeah, I think that that's hugely important. Anytime that presidents, usually after they've left office, they're able to put their political differences to the side, and you see where there's friendships that develop between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and Bill Clinton and President Bush. So you have these opposite political parties, people that defeated each other for the presidential election, but then later becoming friends. And I think that that means so much to the American people to be able to see that.
Now, I understand you've gone to see President George H.W. Bush since his passing. What's your takeaway from all of this and how the country is remembering him and his legacy? I mean, one of the things is when you talk about legacy, it's often a question of, you know, what do we choose to remember? Do we choose to remember the good or the bad? And there's been a lot of back and forth on that. But what's your personal takeaway?
My personal takeaway is that President Bush was president during these iconic changes in world history with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union and the Gulf War. But I believe the major part of his legacy, and again, legacies kind of change over time. So if you'd asked me or if he had passed away shortly after his presidency, his legacy would be much different than it is now in 2018, where he's kind of being held up as a different way that it could be, a different way that it was and a different way that it could be now.
Louis Bacone is a presidential historian and author of The President is Dead. Louis, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.